Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, finally it looks like spring has sprung. Tá an tarach an seo. It's great to see the good weather after such a long, hard winter, and I'm realizing how very Irish I am by starting off with commentary on the weather, but honestly, it's been a tough one, so it's been great to see not only a bit of a stretch in the evening, but to see those higher temperatures. It's been long awaited. We are in that intense period in the semester. Graduation and the end of semester isn't far off. We're into our last month or so of classes, probably our last 3 weeks really officially, and then into exam time. So everyone is just putting that full last push in to get students to the final hurdle, and we look forward to graduation time, in particular for our Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies students who are completing their program this year. Just to let you know, folks, we are still accepting applications for fall of 2015 to the Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies. So if you have an interest in Irish history or literature or the language or the music and culture, do drop us a line or give us a call and come and have a chat to us about the program. We have some significant scholarships available, and they're giving a pretty significant break on tuition with those scholarships. So if you are so inclined, do get in touch with us. We are still accepting applications, I'm happy to say. Now, this week we had a capacity crowd here. We welcomed the former Taoiseach, Deputy Prime Minister and former Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade, Eamon Gilmore, TD, who's still a sitting TD in Dunleary. And he had a chat to us about the IMF bailout and Ireland as it looks towards recovery. It was moderated by Loretta Brennan Glucksman, our founder and one of our best supporters and chair of our board. And it was also moderated by the NYU scholar, Professor Economides, who interjected with some of the economic context, etc. as well. So it was a very interesting gathering. I'm delighted to say that Mr. Gilmore had the time to sit down and have a quick chat with me, and I will be sharing that with you, not on today's program, but very soon, folks. It was a real honour to sit down and have a chat to him about his interactions with Irish America and some of the viewpoints that he has acquired in his pretty lengthy career. So I'll bring that to you sooner rather than later. We have added an event to our program. For any of you who receive our calendar, the hard copy of our calendar, and if you're not on our email list, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that the US launch of the Dirty Dust, or Cray na Chuile, which is Cray na Chuile, the Máirtín Ó Cadhain's famous novel, will take place here on Monday, April 27th at 7 p.m. Again, that is the US launch of Cray na Chuile, and the translation was undertaken by Professor Alan Titley, who is a well-known Irish language scholar. So we're delighted, actually, that evening we'll have not only Alan Titley here, we'll also have Cullum Tobin, because Cullum is going to do an introduction, and we'll have Breen O'Crahour, who is a very well-known scholar from Notre Dame as well. Yale Press has published this very important work through its Margello's World Republic of Letters translation series. And Alan Titley provides a very vigorous new translation, the full brio and guts of O'Kine's original, and bringing the pleasure of this great satirical novel to the far wider audience it deserves. John Badenville has noted that Alan Titley was just the man to put it into English in a wonderfully vivid and vigorous translation, and Seamus Dean has praised the translation for having the idiomatic speed and eagerness of the original and a composer's grasp of tempo and of thematic signature through which the great novel lies again. So, you are welcome to join us for a discussion of this masterful work, which will be led by renowned author Colm Tobin and will feature the translator Professor Alan Titley of my alma mater, University College Cork, and will be joined by Professor Brian O'Crahour, who comes to us by way of Notre Dame and County Kerry. I think Brian is from Tralee. So if you're interested, it's a translation that is being co-published with Clo Iarchonnacht as well on the Irish side. So that is, as I said, Monday, April 27th at 7 p.m. If you are a member, just send us an email to ireland.house@nyu.edu to RSVP. Just to remind you folks as well, and I will remind you next week, on April 30th, we are so excited to be hosting Dorina Allen here for the Irish Institute Lecture. And Dorina is well known as the owner of the Ballymaloe Cookery School in County Cork. She's a very well-known teacher, food writer, and a newspaper columnist, and an all-round really great person who has made a huge contribution to food culture in Ireland. Because of the demand for seats at that event, we're taking it out of the house. We're going to have it in another location here on campus. So that means if you already contacted us and you were told that you couldn't get on the waiting list or that it was full, do get back in touch again, because we do have more spots, because we're moving it up into a bigger event space so we can accommodate the demand. So that is on Thursday, back to our regular Thursday slot. That's Thursday, April 30th at 7 p.m. And I'll have a chat to Dorina when she's in town, and we'll be delighted to share that with you on the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour at some point in time. Now, a few weeks ago, we had the pleasure of hosting here at Glucksman Ireland House a well-known, I suppose he's a man who's probably best known as a poet, Theo Dorgan. We had the benefit of having him here on two occasions when he was in town. Now, he read from Nine Bright Shiners, which is his most recent collection of poems, which was an Irish Times Notable Book of the Year, and he's won multiple awards for his poetry. But while he was also here in town, he had a chat to us about some of the history of James Connolly and the Irish Citizen Army. If you've been reading Irish newspapers or following what's going on in Ireland, of course, in recent months, and indeed really over the last year and a half or year or so now, that period from 1914 through obviously to 1916 and beyond has become very topical. And it was our pleasure to have Theo here to talk a little bit about the research he has done on James Connolly and on his role in the Irish Citizen Army, what went on in terms of this very important period of time. So it's very interesting. He was welcomed by my colleague, Professor John Waters, who is the director of our graduate studies program, and he welcomed him to our class, and it was a very lively discussion on a very interesting topic. So I'd like to share that with you today. As I said, it's quite topical right now because of all the chat that's going on about 1916, about looking back to, you know, it really did start a year and a half ago. It starts with the period of the 1913 Dublin lockout. And of course, Connolly and what goes on around this point in time is very, very key to what ensues in 1916 as well. So I hope you'll enjoy hearing Theo Dorgan being introduced by John Waters on James Connolly and the Irish Citizen Army. So enjoy this, folks.
You're all very welcome. Good to see you here around the table. And it's a special pleasure and delight to welcome, surprisingly to me, for the first time, Theo Dorgan to Glucksman Ireland House. Theo is a novelist, a poet, a noted sailor, now I understand a climber as well, and a translator, and is one of the kind of exemplary figures who have made a life of writing possible through sheer brilliance and force of will in circumstances that change and drift and transform themselves all the time, but he's constantly producing new things and new insights and new work. So it's a pleasure for me to welcome you to Glucksman Ireland House. So Theo's has a paper, but I've encouraged him to approach the subject of today's conversation about James Connolly and the Irish Citizen Army with the freedom of improvisation fully authorized and licensed. So welcome, Theo.
Thank you very much, Sean. Thank you. I always think it's best in... I wouldn't say it's fair to say that an academic environment is hostile to me, but I'm conscious that most people who make their life in the academy do it by dint of considerable application and study. I would not come clean from a courthouse where I was accused of that. My central preoccupation is making sense of being here at all, as opposed to not being in existence at all, and through poetry. But I think everybody has personal and emotional allegiances that obviously that go back into childhood. My father was a lifelong trade unionist. He worked in Dunlop's for 35 years. My mother worked in a factory. They met as factory workers at the Opera in Cork, which was very much supported by the working class in Cork. He was a Labour voter all his life. His advice to me when I became embroiled in incendiary politics as a student was never join anything except your hands. I cannot say that I took his advice. But I am conscious, and I say this in no spirit of false humility, that the only authority I can claim in matters scholarly and political is that it matters to me. I don't believe I bring any particular acumen or depth of study or knowledge to it, but I am conscious of my country and I fear for my country and I've always feared for it. One of the questions that I had an education with the Christian Brothers, it was nowhere near as hysterically nationalist as they make it out to have been. I always think that's an ex post facto construction. But the hinterland, the unquestioned hinterland of history as it was presented to us in school, was a kind of a soft green nationalism. And what always stuck in my mind, since I was a schoolboy, was the troubling and difficult question of James Connolly and Connolly's role and the place of the poor. It was a phrase that became popular in my time as a student, but it's now even penetrated to the heart of the papacy. But the question of what you might call the option for the poor has always concerned me. I had very profound and simple existential reasons for being concerned with how poor related to poverty in the Republic as I grew up. And of course, the figure around whom all these questions constellate is Connolly. And last year, the year before last, I was asked to come and speak on Connolly in Cork City Library, and I wrote a paper about it, not all of which I agree with now. And as you know, it's the nature of things, one is always gathering new information. And if you put a proposition out into the world, you can be absolutely certain that there will be a queue of people to tell you where you got it wrong. I tend to take the perverse attitude that that's a very good thing, and I'm always very grateful for having people point out to me where something is wrong. But the question of Connolly, I had to go and look at some things, and I'm going to read just two quotations from him to kind of set the scene. The question, of course, and you know, the celebration, although I don't think it will be a celebration, the commemoration certainly of 1916, the question that has always haunted me is, why did Connolly commit the ICA to the Rising? In my time, the critique on the left has tended to be inflected by a wish to disinvest the Provisional Republican movement of any legitimacy that might accrue to them in the politics of the day-to-day by associating them with Connolly and with the trade union movement and generally with workers' polity, as it was. So he's been abandoned, if you like, in a kind of a vacuum. The nationalists have never shown any interest whatsoever in seriously dealing with his politics. And the anti-Republicans, as in the sense of the anti-Sinn Féin IRA cadres, have always taken the theologically perfect and unassailable position that it was a backward step to involve the armed echelons and the advanced thinking cadres of the workers' movement in a bourgeois nationalist uprising. It's a very comfortable position to take in the present moment because you can't argue that they're not right. Also, it has an enormous distorting effect because it judges a decision made in 1916 by the criteria and from the perspectives available only in the late 20th century. To give an example, Ruth Dudley Edwards made a great and, kind of self-gratifying excitement out of the idea that Pierce and Connolly, in aiding and abetting him, were pathological victims of the urge towards blood sacrifice. And the fact is that Christopher Clarke shows all of Europe was obsessed with the idea of blood sacrifice at the time of the Rising. Serbia, Bulgaria, Romania, Austria, Germany, Britain, France, Belgium. There was an inevitable, Clarke calls it a sleepwalking towards war, but in every polity across the continent, there was the notion of the redemptive and cleansing value for the national psyche of war. So there was nothing aberrant or particular, it seems to me, to the Irish situation in the idea that war can have a galvanising and a purifying effect on national psyche and help to clarify national interest and give impetus to political projects. I don't think there was any, I don't see that there was anything particularly Irish about that. You could argue that Pierce had, to an extent, a variant on it in that it was influenced by the Catholic idea of sacrifice and the sacrifice on the cross being the exemplary one. But then you could find chunks of that all across Catholic Austria. You could find it in pockets of southern Germany. You could find kind of a Protestant version of the redemptive effect of the blood of the Saviour and the Creator in the English aristocracy. Talked of the glory and the cleansing glory of war. So I come back and back and back to it. And then I said, well, you know, it's very belated. I thought, well, let's see what, you know, Connolly had to say. And because my memory is unreliable, some quotes that I thought might be useful for the day. In the Workers' Republic in July 1900, Connolly wrote this, said, "Ireland, as distinct from her people, is nothing to me. And the man who is bubbling over with love and enthusiasm for Ireland, and can yet pass unmoved through our streets and witness all the wrong and the suffering, the shame and the degradation brought upon the people of Ireland, aye, brought by Irish men upon Irish men and women, without burning to end it, is, in my opinion, a fraud and a liar in his heart, no matter how he loves that combination of chemical elements he is pleased to call Ireland." In 1926, in La Scala, at the foundation meeting of Fianna Fáil, De Valera makes a glancing reference to this when he says that we have made, well, I'll give you the exact quote, but effectively, very belatedly, De Valera catches up with it when he says, "I think I am right also in believing that independence, political freedom, is regarded by most of you as it is regarded by me, simply as a means to a greater end and purpose beyond it." Well, I think that would have come as a considerable news to most of De Valera's followers at that point. He said, "The purpose beyond is the right use of our freedom, and that use must surely include making provision so that every man and woman in the country shall have the opportunity of living the fullest lives that God intended them to live. It is only since I have found how neglected of this purpose many of us are inclined to become that I have been able to sympathise fully with James Connolly's passionate protest. Ireland, as distinct from her people, is nothing to me." Now, this is after the Rising. This is after the War of Independence. This is after the Civil War. It's 1926, 26 years after Connolly published that De Valera somewhat belatedly comes to think that he's only now inclined to sympathise fully with the proposition. Now, I suppose the core of what I'm saying is that the dilemma to be resolved is, why did Connolly commit the ICA to the Rising? He had written passionately and at length about the folly of a politics predicated purely on breaking the connection with England. As far back as July 1899, again in the Workers' Republic, he says, "The problem with the physical force party is that it is a party, that is to say, whose members are united upon no one point and agree upon no single principle except upon the use of physical force as the sole means of settling the dispute between the people of this country and the governing power of Great Britain." Now, by and large, with allowing for the fact that individuals had maybe slightly more complex and developed politics, the Rising as conceived by the IRB and using the volunteers as a vehicle and coming out of what consensus there was between them was dedicated to no other purpose, politically speaking, than breaking the connection with England. In that regard, they're in direct line of descent from the Fenians, who's probably the most extreme expression of it, is O'Donovan Ross's dynamite hard policy. You could argue, I suppose, that the Fenians possibly had a more developed politics in the middle of the 19th century than the IRB and the Volunteers had by 1916. But there are some things we need to remember. The 1916 Rising, as originally conceived, was intended as a nationwide rising. There was a military plan, not the most brilliant plan in the world, but you know, they had about 20,000 rifles, many of them obsolete or semi-obsolete. There was a plan to occupy Limerick, Cork, the key the buildings in Dublin and so on. But no discernible purpose of what to do once that had been done. I think there was a naive assumption that if you seize the physical loci of the state, that somehow the Brits would just say, oh, well, that's grand, so we'll go away. And I mean, I'm going and I'm caricaturing it, but really, in essence, that's what it was. Now, Connolly had developed the politics through the trade union movement, very distinct and different from that of the British trade union movement, with the exception of the Independent Labour Party, which was trying to coalesce a politics of the future inside trade unions. The British unions were still largely craft unions and quite hostile in many cases, certainly in the International. They were very hostile to Connolly's project of building a workers' trade union movement, which would have, as a central dynamic, a will to power, a project of seizing power and exercising authority by virtue of that power. So, however minoritarian his forces were, there was a coherence between the political analysis, the creation of an armed workers' militia, and the continuance of a strategy, what the Italians in the 1970s come to call a strategy of tension. But always there was a goal in mind, and the goal was to seize power, and power in the service of a social program. By contrast, and again I'm simplifying it somewhat, but not enormously, the armed nationalist forces which projected the rising was essentially devoid of a politics. Now, that may or may not, Connolly was then faced with a dilemma. Invited by the inner councils of the IRB, brought into the secret, as it were, that the rising was planned, first of all, he would have been aware that they were inadequately armed. I mean, you have 150,000 fairly modern carbines in the north in the hands of the UVF, and in the south, maximum maybe 20, 22,000 weapons, many of them are semi-obsolete. You had only very unevenly distributed through the volunteer movement and scarcely at all in the IRB any kind of military expertise. But you had a tradition of the doomed and futile gesture, going back to the Fenians, going back to the United Men, and so on. He knew he had more disciplined force, but infinitely smaller. But if he refused to commit the ICA, and we're talking specifically about the ICA now, to the rising, even in considered as a symbolic gesture, what he would have lost was the centrality of the workers to the political project of whatever republic could be built. It's even possible that he considered that as a disciplined force inside a nationalist, inchoate, diffuse rising, they might be in a position to move forward and assume political direction of the movement. If he held the ICA back and the uprising, the insurrection, and I think it's correct to call it an insurrection, and had been in any sense successful, then they would not have a seat at the table. So the workers' movement would have been sidelined. He was perfectly aware that then, as now, Ireland is a profoundly conservative country, and that opportunities for an advanced politics to come to the centre table, at least to the table, if not to any kind of directing power, you simply had to ally yourself with whatever forces were in play and were moving forward. There's another deeper context to this as well. So he had to make a choice. If you go in, it's probably going to be defeated, but that doesn't mean you can't rise again. If you stay out, and it's even partly successful, then you're successfully sidelined, because you have to remember there were moneyed and propertied interests supporting the volunteers as well. And it was a largely petty bourgeois and bourgeois movement in its inclinations, if not its politics. It's indeed arguable that many of them had no politics at all. So he was on a loser if he didn't go in, so he has to go in. But there's another element of this, the critique of Connolly for committing to the rising, which says that, you know, this First World War was, at base, it was an expression of the rapid industrialization of Germany, the appetite of Germany for larger international markets, and the inevitability, as they saw it, of a conflict with British imperial interests. So he has been accused, again by theologians of the left, of simply siding with one imperial power against another. So in some ideal universe, he should have held back and waited for the correct moment to make a move. Now, the fact is that Connolly saw a different Germany to the Germany we now see. And in Ireland, I still think we see Germany at the time of the First World War through British eyes. Most of the publications we have. Well, we were not told, for instance, that 9% of the population of Romania, 16% of the population of Serbia, 20,000 Malays, 90,000 Portuguese perished in the cauldron, in the carnage and slaughter. That was the First World War. We don't get that internationalist perspective. How many Irish people of my generation or younger would know about the great German mutinies of 1918? About the sailors commandeering from Kiel, commandeering a fleet of buses and lorries, and driving to Bremen and sending a signal of support to the Kronstadt revolutionaries. That didn't come out of nowhere either. In 1908, there were about 860,000 trade union members in Germany. By 1914, there were 3,600,000. The trade union movement in Germany had built soup kitchens, creches, kindergartens, schools. They were organizing in the cities as kind of a shadow state inside the state. Now, embryonic, certainly, but quite advanced. And a source of some concern, and this is beginning to come through now in the new German histories, and a source of considerable concern to some of the more alert at the German deep state, not so much the politicians or the Junker class, which was still thinking in terms of cavalry charges and la gloire, but in the deep state and the administrative class, they had a very clear idea of the danger posed by that. Now, it's a traditional, certainly it's a traditional European response. When the poor start getting organized, you have a foreign war. So that was also an element in, I'm going to look at Galtieri and the Falklands Malvinas. But Maggie and Galtieri needed a foreign war for domestic purposes. They both seized that the opportunity with glee. So that's a common reflex, usually from inside the deep state, where the functionaries and the officials, often in the diplomatic services, see. And they have a different perspective of the emergence or cohesion or incoherence of social forces. So what Connolly, the Germany Connolly was looking at, was the Germany that he would have seen as somewhat unstable, as at the level of the working class, the most organized in Europe. And certainly, if any of the working class movements across Europe were in a position to advance to power, the bookies bet, Jimmy the Greek would have been offering shorter odds on Germany than on anywhere else. The British working class was extremely reactionary then, as with some exceptions now. So, the Germany that Connolly saw himself, even though instrumentally it was the then existing government, behind that he saw a different set of forces. So for all of these reasons, I think he was constrained by time, opportunity, circumstance, and the analysis parallel to the insurrectionist proposal. He was compelled to add the ICA to the mix. Come the war of independence, come the first Dáil in 1919, and a deal is struck with William O'Brien and Thomas Johnson and Cathal O'Shannon and the leadership of the Labour movement, that if they stand aside in favour of a clean Sinn Féin slate, that the quid pro quo will be that they will be allowed, if you like, to draft the social programme for the first Dáil. Now, this wasn't out of any enlightened generosity. Partly it was because nobody involved in prosecuting the war of independence, or to an extent inside Sinn Féin, as I understand it, and was in a position to propose a social programme. Not very little time had been devoted to this, so that the only people capable of proposing a social programme for the new state were, in fact, the elements of the Labour movement. Long story short, what you end up with is Richard Mulcahy as TD for Clontarf and Chief of Staff of the IRA proposing the Democratic Programme. And the Democratic Programme was a quite extraordinary document. I think, in terms of its radicalism, it's difficult to conceive of anything that could have been, with the exception that of the pious genuflection towards God and the Irish language. It would have been probably placed somewhere between Kerensky's manifestos and the Bolshevik propositions, of 2 years earlier. It was a very radical document, and it was adopted unanimously. Now, some of the propositions were watered down in the immediate prelude to its introduction, notably by Michael Collins. But such watering down as took place was predicated on the fact that we must do and say nothing that will deflect from the primary aim, which is to break the connection with England. Those are more or less Collins's words. But they adopted it, and they adopted, as I say, an extremely radical program, and immediately abandoned it. Immediately. In 1966, on RTE television, Ernest Floyd said it was the hoisting of a flag, nothing else. Sean McEntee said, we had, of course, no possibility of introducing this. Even if we had introduced such a socialist proposal, even the workers themselves would have doubted our sincerity. Which is a bit rich coming from McEntee. But the sum total and effect was Connolly gambled and lost. I think he lost. But then I think he was in a no-win situation. His calculation was that if the nationalist petty bourgeois putsch, and I think in this instance Trotsky was right and Lenin was wrong. Lenin defended it, defended the rising. Trotsky said it was no more than a putsch. Lenin took a slightly more benign view of it in July 1916. He said that anyone who describes this as a putsch is a deep-dyed reactionary. I'm inclined to touch to hyperbole with Vladimir Ilyich. Deep-dyed reactionary and one with no eye for true revolutionary potential. I don't think all the facts, put it charitably, not all the facts were in. I think he might not have been quite so emphatic. But, as I said, Connolly, I think, gambled and lost. The last straw of the dice, on the face of it, the introduction of the democratic program, which came directly out of the political formations which Connolly, in a loose sense, commanded, would have been a considerable achievement if adopted. But, of course, it was that classic Irish thing, a pious statement of intention which nobody has any intention whatsoever of honouring. If he'd stayed out, I think things would have been not a whit different. I think the same forces would have come into play. What copperfastened it all was 1922, faced with the Free State or immediate and terrible war. At that stage, having had the experience of combat, having discovered that in actual war, real people are horrifically wounded and killed. You know, a lesson which first was proved on the pulses of the insurrectionary forces in Easter week, that for all the sunburstery, as Frank O'Connor later termed it, writing from Cork jail as a prisoner in the Civil War, all the sunburstery was punctured very, very quickly, as brutally in Ireland as it was in the trenches of the Somme and Ypres and Passchendaele. When you discover Wilfred Owen's great poem, when you discover what is actually involved in war, whether a small minor war such as the one we had in Ireland or the larger mechanised, organised, industrial slaughter of the Western Front, you discover very interesting that glory is a very thin shield against lead. And I think that there was that horror in Ireland of the consequences of actual people whom you knew dying, being horrifically wounded yourself. The reality had impinged. The reality had also impinged that this theoretical editorial line that somehow Britain is too tied up on the continent to actually engage with insurrectionary forces. And there would have been, I actually believe there would have been, immediate and terrible war in Ireland would have been a terrible war. So they did the best they could with the treaty. One of the nastier betrayals of the 20th century was when De Valera gave the delegation plenipotentiary powers and then reneged them when they came back with the deal, which they were perfectly entitled to come back with. A number of consequences, I think, flow from that as well, which we can talk about in a while, specifically in relation to partition and the ongoing sort of partition. But the forces of the organised forces, the ICA, effectively disintegrated. The trade union movement was sidelined into a social corral. And the ambitions of the trade union movement to become a workers' movement in a different way, in a different sense, one with a political project of its own, was sidelined. And you have a party suddenly finds itself in power with no program, but with the immediate urgent necessity of conducting the business of the state, of providing for policing, of providing for electricity, for education, for agriculture, all of those things which are the business. The state apparatus. So they did the only thing you could argue that they could have done, from a pragmatic point of view. And they took over the entire corpus of civil and criminal law in the UK. They took over the methods of organising government departments. They took over effectively. And there was more than a hint of truth in the jibe that the only thing that changed was that the harp replaced the shamrock on the post boxes and on the stationery. But Michael Hartnett writes, and so in 1922 with smiles on our lips, we queued up at the castle in 1922 with smiles on our lips and entered the Irish paradise of files and paperclips. A couple of years after the Civil War, at that great torpor and freeze set in. Yeah, it would have been possible to forget that there was ever an insurrectionary movement, certainly that there was an organized and armed labor movement. The great torpor set in as the deep state began to take root, and what had been the colonial apparatus continued. The civil servants who had stood back, they who had stood back from the conflict, who carefully expressed a view neither this way nor the other, moved in. Within a couple of months, you had a full-size standing army, uniformed and armed. You had guys chasing from every corner of the country to sign up to the Free State Army, cheerfully prepared to shoot people who'd won them the liberty to wear the uniform. And you had the Republican anti-treaty run, which embarked on the disastrous course, repetition of the ongoing stupidity of opposing a political project in force of arms, and once again taking on superior forces, and against the vote of the Dáil, whose feats of arms they had helped establish. So, you know, I have no patience for the line of constantly revisiting history, saying what it should have been as well. But it's difficult not to regret that the anti-treaty forces didn't form a coherent political argument against the treaty and argue against it as an opposition inside the framework of the Dáil. It would have had the effect of strengthening the mandate of the Dáil. It would have taken the gun out of an asymmetric position where it could not achieve such political objectives as they had. And it allowed the notion to emerge that you don't actually need a politics to contest for power in Ireland. And for a very long time, you could argue still, the core belief is that politics in Ireland is about who's in authority and not about the content of a politics. So that's about as far as my small brain can take me. There are points, I'm sure, but there are places in that general analysis that I'm not sure I agree with myself on. But I do think Connolly said a very interesting thing when he said that, and you know, I can give you the exact quote, but I'll condense it in saying we have an unfortunate tendency of pursuing revolutionary politics in Ireland with Parliament, with all the tedium of parliamentarianism, and of attempting to conduct our parliamentary politics in the incendiary language of insurrection revolutionism. And I think we're still there. Now, I mean, it's another question where we're going now. I think we're at a very interesting point now where people are actually, and surprising themselves in many issues, and sometimes incoherently, looking for a politics with an actual content, which is kind of, you know, it's certainly a surprise to the deep state, but it's a kind of a novelty to the Irish people as well.
Can I throw a question or two your way, Theo? I mean, the first one would be, I was pleased that you put your own background in and sort of familial and personal history with trade unionism to the fore in introducing your talk on Connolly, because it highlights an issue for me about the question of leadership and our concentration on the outstanding intellectual of the movement and James Connolly. But of course, he does have 1,500 committed followers and supporters and people of great ability and people of great insight as well. And so one of the questions becomes, what happened? Is the decapitation of the ICA with James Connolly, is the body much more grievously wounded than just the decapitation with Connolly, such that how do we understand the splintering and the sort of falling away that happens after the rising and makes it possible for the situation which you describe, which I wouldn't quarrel with in its basic outline. But how do you see the other figures who surround Connolly and their view? I mean, one person whom we know of here is Sean O'Casey, and O'Casey's embrace of a kind of humanist pacifism and his very trenchant critique of joining the rising. But I wonder, do you have any thoughts about that issue of the idea that if it's a broader movement than the decision making and the figurehead of the party leader, as it were, or the ideologue, does that obscure something?
I suppose, as best as I understand it, if you go back to Lenin's admonition to the party, always explain, patiently explain. You have to ask, who was there left to explain what Connolly's thesis or Connolly's motivations had been? and, you know, Johnson, and I think possibly the most interesting one was Cathal O'Shannon, yeah. Even though he was, like myself, a bit of a flitterer, you know, he wasn't a passionately committed ideologue. But he had some understanding of the link between passion of national aspiration and the day-to-day realities of how people lived. Bluntly, one of the reasons why so many people flocked to the Free State Army is that it filled the void left by the impossibility of joining the British Army after the War of Independence. And people needed jobs. And the uniform, 3 square meals a day, and a good solid pair of boots. And this was up into the 1960s, 70s, where people were joining the FCA for the boots and the overcoat.
Yeah.
Silly as that sounds, I mean, a lot of people were actually that poor. Poverty and the destruction of, well, agriculture was certainly, as far as I can make out, quite a hammering by 1922. And then you had the oncoming problems of the cattle trade. As late as 1973, when we went into the EEC, there were 280,000 family farms in Ireland. That was about 40,000. So the extremely reactionary Catholic Archbishop of Cork and Ross of my childhood was proved exactly right, even though he was sneered at by the political classes for saying it. So an awful lot of people were dependent on subsistence living. But 1922, infant mortality in the inner city of Dublin was 161 per thousand. In the east end of London, it was 61 per thousand. So you had basically no social assistance network worth speaking of. The economy was in profound decline, and people were simply scrabbling to stay alive. The question of why did the Bolsheviks have to liquidate, in that unlovely phrase of theirs, so many of the workers, because starving, they were ripe for, as Trotsky was, to embrace reaction. So, you know, the analogy would be with extirpating cancer cells. The cancer of need is always a threat to the state. Because when people simply want to put that famous loaf of bread on the famous family table, they will do very simple things, and they'll rarely be motivated by deep and considered political analysis. Education was extraordinarily poor, so I mean, most people would not have had the ability to stand back and perform an analysis of their own best interests. The history of the disorganized poor in Europe since the French Enlightenment is that one of the most difficult tasks is to get people to consider their own best interests. I think of that when I see poor whites in Alabama and Tennessee clearly in need of severe remedial dental work and nutritional advice, railing about how dare the government offer temerity to offer new medical care. So, you know, people don't always act in their own best interests, and they address, as far as I can certainly, the poor always have an extremely short horizon, the next meal, the next pair of shoes, the worn out overcoat and winter coming. So they will do small things, small things, small things. And if you have, you know, as is my belief, you have the elements of a deep state, which is quite conservative. If you have someone like W.T. Cosgrave saying that, I mean, he used more polite terms, but what Lenin would call the lump of proletariat, would do us a favour if they were going to emigrate, please, and take themselves off social assistance and take themselves out of the way, the unproductive and idle poor, they call them. If that's the attitude of the state, and there aren't enough jobs to perpetuate a tradition of political education inside a trade union.
Well, one of the pieces of research that some of our students and faculty have kind of begun to look at here is, and this is a sort of well-known feature of Irish American history, it's just the shot in the arm of to trade unionism in the United States that comes from the Republican exiles that come here in 22 and 23. 2,000 or 3,000 nationalists, but also some committed socialists. And the left spectrum of nationalism in Ireland is severely crimped between 22 and 26, and several thousand of them come to the United States. And so New York labor history, Pittsburgh labor history, Cleveland labor history, Chicago labor history, they're deeply impacted by, you know, in some cases a few dozen, in some cases 100 or 1,000 people who come in and who are politically aware. Of course, they're gone from the Irish context from that point.
Well, a lot of those, I would imagine, would be, and I don't have any direct familiarity with the research, but I would imagine a lot of those were people who saw that in that project in which they had invested so much, of which many of them risked their lives, independence turned out to be a chimera. You know, Bruce Springsteen says, here comes the new boss, same as the old boss. And that can have a radicalizing effect, but at the same time can drive people into exile, because here is no country for young men. Yes. 98, here's no country for young men. There's a folk story about, I've never been able to trace its actual origin, but there's a widely held believed folk story about Paddy O'Donnell writing a piece in, of all places, the Irish press, excoriating De Valera's government for the number of Irish people who'd emigrated. And Dev was so upset, he rings Paddy. Says, Paddy, the world is in a very bad state. All the economies in the world are in a terrible condition. Ireland isn't unique in this. Paddy, if you'd have been Taoiseach, there'd have been a million emigrants. And Paddy's response, said to have been, yeah, Dev, but they'd have been a different million. And it's one of those many stories. I have no intention of trying to discover if it's true or not, because I don't want to spoil the good story. But there's a truth in that. See, one of the difficulties, too, of course, is that we don't really have any serious labour history project from the ground up in Ireland. And I mean, I'm an anomalous creature of the working class poor, who changes class immediately once he gets an education. And we do well to remember that. You change your class perspectives, and not your class allegiance, but your class perspective. I look back on the history of the state as best I can. I'm sure very muddled and confused, but I look back on it from the point of view of somebody who is looking through the lens of education, of other people's scholarship, of habituation of thought. And my father would not have had that luxury. So how politics impinges directly on the pulses of the poor is very often difficult to discern. I don't want to glamorise or idealise Connolly either, because I don't think Connolly had brought forward far enough. He certainly hadn't brought forward an analysis that would be of use to his successors after his death. I think there were still work, the trade union movement certainly, and the brighter elements who'd straddled into the ICA but were also branch secretaries or just shop stewards. They were feeling their way forward towards something, I suppose, something like what became the politics of the Republican Congress. But it was still being worked out in the living moment. And I know I'm prone to looking back and saying, why could I not have seen that if X had linked with Y? But of course, in the living moment, those things are never apparent. And again, you come back to the unevenness of education. In 1889, Connolly talked about the alternative to the physical force movement as being a principal policy of educating the class and working through the ballot box. You know, I have the quote there somewhere.
And the strike.
Yeah.
And the one big strike.
Yeah. But he believed that it would be possible to... he says here, this was what... When was that... I'll give you the reference in a minute. The policy of the Socialist Republicans is seen to be the only wise one. Educate that you may be free. Principles first, methods afterwards. If the advocacy of physical force failed to achieve success or even to effect an uprising when the majority were unenfranchised and the secret ballot unknown, how can it be expected to succeed now that the majority are in possession of voting power and the secret ballot safeguards the voter? The ballot box was given us by our masters for their purpose. Let us use it for our own. Let us demonstrate at that ballot box the strength and intelligence of the revolutionary idea. Let us make the hustings a rostrum from which to promulgate our principles. Let us grasp the public powers and the interests of the disinherited class. Now that's an unexceptional aspiration, in itself. But he hadn't arrived at it, and I don't think anybody had arrived at it. But how do we construct the apparatus by which we march to power and then deal with the difficulties of power? And it's always been one of the problems, hasn't it, with syndicalism, is that it knows what it wants to get rid of, but it balks at a proposition. It's why Marxism became unreasonably discredited in the 20th century. Is Leninism knew exactly what it wants to do. So you have a Marxist analytic and a Leninist prospectus. And so that Marxism as an analytic tool becomes discredited, extensively discredited, because of the bastardization of Leninism. The power to the party, and power in the party to the Politburo, and power in the Politburo to whatever cabal is sitting down when the music stops with the parcel in their hands. And it was two or three years ago, wasn't it? The Wall Street Journal said the best analysis of the current crisis of finance capital in the world is to be found in Karl Marx's Das Kapital. The problem is he had the right questions, but the wrong answers, the right answers to what's wrong, but not the right prescription for what to do. But I mean, I thought that was, I mean, to the extent that you can use the phrase about the Wall Street Journal, fair-minded. You know, in the sense, but certainly it was an accurate read of how certainly the emergency finance capital was predicted. But you have to ask how many people in Ireland had even read Capital at the time, or how many people, having read it, were in a position to form study circles and explain.
Or how many read Labour in Irish history?
Well, yeah. I mean, how many? I'd love to know how many people in the upper echelons of the trade union movement in Ireland have read Labour in Irish history and can read it without blushing.
It's fascinating to hear Theo Dorgan's reflections on James Connolly and the Irish Labour movement. Many of you will know his name as one of the signatories of the Irish Proclamation, and indeed he was killed by firing squad in May 1916 following the Easter Rising. But for those of you who didn't know his background, it's clear that Ireland infused his life really from the beginning. He was born in 1868 to immigrants from County Monaghan, and he was raised in Edinburgh. At the age of 14, he joined the British Army and was stationed in Ireland for 7 years. There he met Lily Reynolds, who was from County Wicklow, my own home county, whom he married in 1890. He was a fiercely devoted family man, and Lily always supported his work, moving their big family across the Atlantic Ocean in 1904. And finding creative ways to feed them when he had no income. They had 7 children, Mona, Nora, Aideen, Ina, Moira, Roderick and Fiona. Now, Connolly's own formal schooling ended at the age of 10, and thereafter he was self-taught, devouring the works of writers like Marx and Engels. He was drawn to socialism while living in Scotland, and upon moving to Dublin in 1896, he founded the Irish Socialist Republican Party, calling for public ownership by the Irish of the land and instruments of production, distribution and exchange. As editor of the ISRP newspaper, The Workers' Republic, and as a contributor to publications like the Shan Van Vught, he supported universal suffrage, free education, a 48-hour work week and a minimum wage. The influence of John Mitchell and James Fintan Lawler emerged as early as 1897, when Connolly became active in Irish nationalism by protesting Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. He also published the first edition of Aaron's Hope, which he revised in 1909 while in the United States. So Connolly is quite interesting. You know, there's a really strong connection between the United States and many of the prominent Irish figures that we think of during this time. And in saying that, I'm thinking of Tom Clark, who spent time here in the United States. Obviously, John Devoy is here. Jeremiah O'Donovan Rossa is here. And then to more Labour leaders like Big Jim Larkin as well. So the United States was a very important influence. During Connolly's time in the United States, there was a constant tug of war between his revolutionary aspirations and his need for wages, you know, like most people, the day-to-day logistics and pragmatic impulses were weighing upon him. He's a family man. Being a Socialist Party organizer did not pay well, if at all, and his publishing efforts, except for Socialism Made Easy, which sold 40,000 copies, were often self-financed. In Troy, New York, he collected insurance premiums until a walkout by the young women in its collar factories found him raising strike funds instead. Out of a job, he got a job at the Singer Sewing Machine Factory in Elizabeth, New Jersey, settling the family in nearby Newark. There he learned both German and Italian to encourage new immigrants. Moving to the Bronx, he became an organizer for the industrial workers of the world. America taught Connolly the value of a labor movement that welcomed all workers regardless of nationality or skill, and it also taught him a bitter lesson. He's quoted as saying, in America, the ambition of the toiler is to be a slave driver instead of a slave. This applies not only to the native-born Americans, but to the working class of America as a whole. Irish as much as any other, the spirit of America is on them, the spirit of grab. So he's very, very interesting. We're going to hear a lot more about him over the next year or so as we turn into our commemoration of 1916. And as I said, I'm delighted to have had the opportunity to share with you Theo Dorgan's insights and contemplations on this very interesting character. I must mention that my colleague Marion Casey, along with Daphne Dyer-Wolf, curated an exhibit on James Connolly in America. It was entitled Labour and Dignity, James Connolly in America. We're hoping it's currently out in the Midwest, possibly trying to think if it's Milwaukee, but we're hoping to get that exhibit back to New York City. It was only here for a brief period in 2013, so we're hoping to get it back here at some point to the East Coast and hopefully to New York City in particular, so people can take a look at some of the particular aspects of his interactions with the United States in particular. It's a rather understudied aspect of James Connolly's life, and I think Theo Dorgan did a great job in highlighting and asking questions about some of our assumptions about him and about how Irish politics and I suppose class influenced the Irish political scene over a protracted period. So we'll have more on that. At some point, I'd like to get Daphne Dyer-Wolf, who curated the exhibit with Marion Casey and is herself a PhD student at Drew. She's also a former MA in Irish and Irish American Studies student. She did her master's with us there a few years ago and is not only a very nice person, but a great scholar. So perhaps at some point we'll be able to get Daphne in to talk a little bit more in depth about James Connolly in America in particular, because there is a lot more on that angle as well. So, we're coming towards the end of the programme for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again same time next Saturday on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and at irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer Jamie Sweeney, who I couldn't live without, our email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu. And if you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour or to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flannery Show up next on WBNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Thanks for tuning in, folks. I hope you can get out and enjoy some good weather for the rest of the weekend. Slán agus beannacht.